Radio B.
It's time to hear from the Green Party.
Good morning, Steve Abel from the Green Party. How are you, mate?
Good, very well, thank you.
Now, this morning we're starting with the news that the government has just introduced legislation to remove the ban on offshore oil and gas drilling, which is going to have its first reading in the House this week.
Yeah, today, in fact. Yes, well, I mean, in case you're in any doubt about how regressive the Luxon government is, they're really doubling down on that kind of anti-environment strategy, and particularly the opening up of oil, gas and coal, you know, and I suppose in the simplest terms, you know, what we know is for us to have a livable planet by the end of the century, we have to leave oil, gas and coal in the Earth's crust, and
yes,
extracting oil and gas is not the way to go. And specifically, the International Energy Agency did a report saying that there should be no new oil and gas exploration at all from 2021. And we were obviously meeting that target by saying that we wouldn't issue new permits from 2018 when the ban came into place. And this government is backtracking on that and going against the climate science.
Wow. Now, the government claims that this move is necessary for energy security. How do you reconcile energy security with the need to meet environmental and climate commitments?
Yeah, it's a good question. The major challenge we've got in New Zealand is a complete unwillingness on the part of the two legacy parties to actually fix the energy market. We have a real energy market problem whereby the dirtiest forms of energy are also the most expensive, and when they are being put into the grid in terms of coal being burned at Huntly, that expensive price set as a spot price on the market and in the wholesale market allows all of the hydro, which is most of our electricity, to be sold at the cost of the coal, which means it's sold for a lot more than it actually costs.
Okay, all right.
And that needs to be fixed. That's why these recent closures at the mill, for example, have happened, because the very high spot price in the wholesale market has meant that they can't afford to pay for the energy. There is obviously a declining gas supply, and that's happened faster than the gas industry thought it would happen. They have produced since the last having gas up to 2061. And what was needed when the ban came into place was a big investment in new renewable generation, the likes of wind and solar and some geothermal. That didn't happen in the last 6 years as fast as it should have. It definitely is what needs to happen now. But digging up new oil, gas and coal is not the solution. That same energy and investment in terms of a political position and money should be going into renewables. That's the way to go.
Just winding back there, this, I guess, is a criticism of the wholesale retail energy producers. But the John Key government partially privatised the major gentailers, power generator retailers, resulting in billions of dollars of dividends being paid out as opposed to prioritising new renewable electricity generation. What concerns do you have about the power generator retailers choosing not to invest in renewable energy? What regulatory changes do you think are necessary to incentivize them to prioritize sustainable solutions?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a great question, and that is exactly to the heart of it, really, is that basically the general retailers have sat on their hands and explicitly not invested in new renewables because it would reduce the amount of fossil fuels going into the mix, which allows them to sell what renewables they do have at a higher price, as I just described. So that's a kind of a perverse incentive for the generator retailers to not build new renewable, which we need. And for context, that we need to think about our whole energy system. Only 40% of our whole energy system is renewable, while up to 95% of our electricity system is renewable. But how do we get off our dependence on imported oil, which is what runs our transport fleet? We electrify our transport systems, electric trains and buses and bikes and cars. And that's the solution. Then we're using domestically generated electricity to power our transportation. Now, for that to happen, we do need to build a lot more renewable, because we're not just getting rid of the renewable in the grid and the electricity system. We're actually creating renewable electricity to then power our transport fleet. So electrification of our transportation is the way for us to, you know, get off our dependence on imported oil, which is a many billions of dollars each year we spend to import oil into New Zealand. And so having a system where you've got a profit incentive in the electricity system and sector means they don't want to reinvest that money, and we need to find a way to make them reinvest that money. Is the position I would say is we say you guys have to invest in your renewables.
Yes. Just on public sentiment around this, do you think the public perceives the government's reversal of on this issue of opening up oil exploration and gas drilling as a bad move? Do you think the public is shocked by this? How do you see, I mean, are you seeing any increased support for the green policies in light of these developments?
I think the public are predominantly against it. I mean, there's polling that's been done from the time of the ban coming into place over the last few years, which shows that the public supported the ban on new oil and gas exploration. I think that you've got a very strong kind of narrative coming out of the current government, which is trying to talk up the value of mining and coal mining and oil and gas exploration. So how much that's affected public sentiment, I'm not sure. But I think any instance where we're able to have a sensible conversation about what life on Earth looks like by the end of the century means that we have to have the ability to recognise that climate change is an existential threat, and it requires us to stop putting carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere at such huge volumes. And what we have is, you know, old dogs like Shane Jones, you know, condemning our grandchildren to a future of unimaginable suffering, to use the language of the Secretary General of the United Nations, because that's what we face if we don't deal with climate change. And so it's sort of a very unethical position in terms of intergenerational justice for us to be burning oil, gas and coal.
Yes. Now, Steve, moving along to the next story of the week, the government is having a look at the Marine and Coastal Area Act, which contains rules that take the right of iwi to make claims on their customary waters. What is the government intending to do by making adjustments to this act?
Yeah, so I mean, you remember 2004, the Fortune and Seabed legislation that the Clark government brought in, which caused the massive, amazing hikoi down to Wellington. That was an effective confiscation of customary rights to the Takatai wine of the Fortune and Seabed from Māori. And that's why there was such huge opposition from Māori against it. And then in 2011, the John Key government came, and in fact, that protest led to the breakaway, you know, creation of Te Papi Māori in the late 2000s. And then in 2011, the Key government came and they brought in a new piece of legislation by negotiation with Te Papi Māori, who they were in coalition with, which was the Takutai Moana Act, which peddled back some of that confiscation. Not as much as would have been ideal, but it did bring it back. Work by Māori were then able to make claims to their customary waters out to their exclusive economic zone. And so this legislation is an amendment to that law, the Takutai Moana Act, which was John Key's effort to amend somewhat that confiscation. But what this government is doing is it's making that an even higher bar than what it currently is. It's cutting out a whole lot of access to customer claims for Māori to their Takutai Moana. So it's another example of kind of anti-Māori, anti-treaty policy by the Luxon government. And again, it's another example of this national government being more reactionary and regressive than even the John Key government.
This seems to have happened quite quietly. I haven't seen a lot of coverage of this. Would you say they're trying to be kind of sneaky about this one?
Yeah, there were documents released that showed there was a conversation that went on between Shane Jones and Paul Goldsmith, in which somebody referred to a judge as a communist, and Goldsmith made a comment that Māori should only have access to 5% of the exclusive economic zone area rather than have rights to make claims on up to 100% of it. And that came out and sort of revealed this intention. So that's part of the inside thinking from this government on why they're doing this. And just for clarity, the Waitangi Tribunal made it very clear that there's no evidence that Māori having customary claim to the exclusive economic zone changes the access that the rest of New Zealanders have to it.
Mm.
It's just about recognising their fundamental treaty rights of Te Ngāti Tauranga over their customary waters.
Steve, how do you view the influence of corporate interests in shaping this potential legislation change, and what implications does it have for Māori rights and environmental justice?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think that if you look at the anti-treaty position, particularly the treaty principles bill from the ACT Party, is that it's very much about getting Te Tiriti o Waitangi out of the way to make it easier for corporate access to exploitation of natural resources, for example. So it's perceived by those sort of neoliberals at a sort of philosophical or ideological level as being a threat to the right of corporations to exploit nature for private profit. And so the attacks on Te Tiriti, it is my view, are founded in that ideological view that Indigenous rights and upholding our founding agreement, which Te Tiriti is a barrier to sort of a pure free market, yeah, neoliberal exploitation. And so I do think that's a big part of what's going on. And, you know, the Luxembourg government is a government, you know, a dog wagged by two tails, basically. New Zealand first on one side and ACT on the other. And this is an example of where the worst instincts of the National Party are being amplified by the extreme positions of the ACT Party and the New Zealand First Party.
Okay, Steve, I reckon we've got time for one more quick one. These are all heavy topics. I'm sorry to rush through them, but another story that's been in the news this week has been child poverty. And Minister for Child Poverty Reduction, Louise Upton, has rejected official advice that $3 billion a year is needed to fix child poverty. They're going to focus on, the economy to try and fix it. What is your stance on the government's choice to prioritise tax cuts for landlords over fixing child poverty levels?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating similar figure, isn't it? $2.9 billion in tax cuts to landlords, and what it would take to deal with child poverty is $3 billion. I don't think it any more starkly shows up the reality that poverty in this country is a political choice, that we know what it takes to deal with these problems, and it does take investment. And this government is explicitly choosing to give more money to those who least need it, i.e. landlords, people who can afford to own more than just their own home, but multiple properties potentially, and rent them out for making money. It favours them over those who are most in need in our country, and those who are absolutely, unable to do anything but deal with the circumstances in which they are born, which is children. But that is a reality for adults too, born into poverty. And our position as the Greens was that we need to double the Best Start program from $69 a week for children under 3 years old, apply it to all children under 3 years old, make it $140 per week.
Mm.
Those sorts of very simple investments make a real difference in people's,
yes,
lives. Free,
yeah,
school lunches in schools is another really important thing to ensure that people don't go hungry, children don't go hungry. Fundamentally, you can pay for these things by things like a wealth tax. We have, you know, a very small number of families earning more than almost half of the rest of New Zealand in terms of their wealth, and paying half of the effective tax that most New Zealanders are paying. So there's real inequities and injustices in our tax system. Things like a wealth tax would help correct that. I just see the head of the ANZ today saying that, yesterday saying that they support a capital gains tax. That's another way of helping to correct the big polarisation of wealth in our country. Mm. Those who, when they realise the value of a capital investment, such as a property, a percentage of that is then taxed and goes back to the coffers, rather than only taxing income, which in a sense acts as a disincentive to work, you might say, because it's not something we want to disincentivise.
Yes.
We do kind of want to disincentivise property speculation.
Yeah.
And so those sorts of taxes, send the right messages to the community about what we value, but also allow us to pay to fix problems like child poverty, which are eminently fixable. Things like free dental care was one of our policies for all New Zealanders last election, and that's something that was hugely popular. When you combine the prospect of free dental care with being paid for by a wealth tax, there was like over 60% of New Zealanders supported a wealth tax on that basis, because most people say, yeah, we're happy to have a wealth tax. So it means we get better health care and we get warm, dry housing.
Yes, when there's a clear outcome.
Yeah.
Hey, Steve Abel from the Green Party, thank you so much for chatting to us this morning. We'll look forward to speaking with you in a couple of weeks' time.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Cheers, mate.
That was the Green Party. The Wire. BFM.
It's really softened up and it's gone smooth.